Coming up on this edition of the Golf Digest podcast, we chat with Matt Kuchar's caddy, John Wood, and break down the PGA Tour's return.
My God, my swing feels like an unfolding lawn chair.
Well, why do they even have one if you're not supposed to hit it there?
Because it's fun! We're having fun!
What is this, custom? Mine's off the rack.
I wish Tiger Woods was here to help me with this.
We'll do it live!
Welcome back to the Golf Digest podcast. I'm Alex Myers. Today I'm joined by Sam Wyman, Daniel Rappaport. Obviously, we have a chat with John Wood, Matt Kuchar's caddy, a veteran PGA Tour caddy coming up in a bit. He's going to fill us in on the entire scene that went down at Colonial Country Club for the Charles Schwab Challenge. But first off, guys, what was it like, I guess, watching golf again, real golf, not a made-for-TV event, but I mean, the tour was back and it seemed to go off okay.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was great to have the tour back. I think it's the little things that you don't realize that you miss, like following a guy who you maybe put in a fantasy lineup or made a bet on, and he's won over through four holes, and you're freaking out, and then he makes a birdie, and you know, the little ebbs and flows of a PGA Tour event that you don't get in these made for TV events when there's only four guys. You know, 148 players, I think what it was, teed it up this week, and everyone's got action on different guys, and everyone's rooting for different guys for different reasons. And then the tournament itself was obviously super compelling. We had a loaded leaderboard going into the weekend. It changed a lot. It felt like everyone, because 18 was a birdie hole, it felt like everyone had a putt on 18 to get to 15 under, get to 16 under. And then obviously the drama with the missed putts at the end from Schauffele and a couple from Morikawa, Berger sneaking up late. Yeah, it was a great return, and I think it was further proof that, you know, the fans aren't what make players nervous. You know, it's the prestige, and it's the FedEx Cup points, and it's the money. It's, you know, the fans are, definitely add something, but, you know, Colin Morikawa doesn't miss a three-footer, you know, just doesn't just happen. You know, that he was nervous, and it wasn't just because the fans. So I think it was a big success.
I was going to say that, you know, there's so many elements of professional tournament golf that you miss, and you touched on some of those. And I would say one of those elements is – just sort of the typical trajectory of a golf tournament, where you have, you know, some compelling, you know, first Thursday and Friday leaders, and, you know, this great leaderboard on Saturday, and then Sunday kind of like an underwhelming finish, which is, you know, kind of another trademark or can be a trademark of PGA Tour golf. Like everything kind of culminates on Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock. And, you know, you had this opportunity for some really notable winners. Daniel Berger is a worthy champion, but, you know, he's the type of guy that would win any week on the PGA Tour and not this sort of historic week.
Yeah, and it felt like Morikawa, I mean, that was really his tournament to lose. Like, you know, he had the putt on 18, and you just got the sense that it was such a huge opportunity for him. Yes, he's already won, but he won an opposite field event, and it was Stapleford scoring, and this was different. You know, this was the first event back. All eyes were on this tournament, and the leaderboard, the quality of the field was incredible. You know, he's made 21 cuts in a row, but you get the sense that a win like this over a field like this really could have been significant for his progression in his career. And I'm not saying, you know, he seems like a really, we actually had him on the podcast, what was it, you know, a month ago.
Yeah.
Really smart kid, really confident kid. You know, he's smart about his game. You hope it doesn't damage his confidence too much. I don't think it will, but I think winning yesterday, you know, if he had made that putt on 18 and he wins by one and beats all those guys and moves up to, you know, something like number 20 in the world, and all of a sudden, you know, he's no longer just a good young player who's coming up. He's, you know, one of the top 20 players in the world.
Yeah, it was a huge opportunity for him to, you know, become a household name, obviously. And yeah, Daniel Berger's not the biggest name, but there were so many great storylines on that leaderboard. You're right. The finish ended up fizzling out just a little, but, you know, with Xander and Bryson and the Jordan Spieth experience, it was pretty exciting. I think, you know, even the casual fan had a lot to watch. Now, that being said, you're right. It probably would have been better if a superstar had won just to get more interest. But yeah, I mean, good for Daniel Berger. Daniel Berger came in with back-to-back top fives. Now, the first of those happened 4 months ago, but you know, he's been playing some really good golf. He has 28 rounds in a row of par or better. You know, he's 14th in strokes gained total. So, you know, he's had a quiet, really good year. You know, he's a guy who's battled wrist injuries the last couple of years. He was a former PGA Tour Rookie of the Year. For whatever reason, he seems to dominate the second week of June. All three of his wins now have come then, but no, it was still exciting. But you're right, Dan. Colin Morikawa, I mean, this guy is incredible. He is going to really do some damage on tour. He still moved up to 27th in the world, but had he won, he probably would have been in the top 15.
Would he have gone that high? Top
probably. 15? Yeah. Wow. I mean, Berger went up 76 spot. Berger went up to 31. You know, Morikawa has never missed a cut so far since he's turned pro. He's just so consistent. He's one of the best iron players already. He's going to be a star. Again, though, the casual golf fan probably wouldn't have known who he was either when they tuned in, but they are going to know about him.
But I think your Dan's point about, you know, him being on our podcast, like, he's the type of guy that you want to kind of elevate to the next level because he's got the 100%. Personality to sort of become a guy that people really want to follow and want to succeed. Because I was definitely impressed by him when we had him on.
Yeah, just like no pretension. You know, he's not one of the guys who drinks his own, you know, Kool-Aid. He seems to be really level-headed, and he'll get there. You know, I don't think anyone has a doubt. You make 21 cuts in a row to start your career. It's not exactly apples to apples when you compare him to like some of the other rookies that we've had, like, you know, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, because they were so young. And Morikawa was 23, right? He graduated from Berkeley, so it's he came to the tour with a more established game. But if you look at his stats through 21 events compared to Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth, he's got better stats than they do in the first 21 events of his career. So he's a guy who I think will be here for a long time. And, you know, we always compare him with Matt Wolff and Victor Hovland because they all came up at the same time. But, you know, Wolff gets a lot of the headlines and a lot of the deals because of his swing, and Hovland is a great player too. But it does seem like Morikawa has kind of elevated himself as the premier player of that group. And you have to think, at this point, you have to think he's more likely than not to be on the next Ryder Cup team, whenever that would be.
What about just from watching in general on TV? You know, I kind of thought that it wouldn't look that different. I thought it might sound a lot different with there not being a crowd there. And it certainly did. But I don't know, after a few minutes, I kind of didn't even notice. What were your guys' thoughts on the coverage and how it
went? I agree. I mean, first of all, I think, you know, if you watch enough tournament golf on Thursday and Friday, you're used to guys playing in front of sparse crowds. I mean, because there's invariably going to be a leader who's 600 par and playing in front of, you know, his wife and, you know, his agent. So that part is not that rare. I know a lot of the architecture geeks cited the fact that, you know, the lack of grandstands and the lack of fans, you know, created new lines and new, you know, angles that you normally wouldn't see. That actually was pretty cool. I mean, mm-hmm. It was definitely like interesting to see guys kind of fly it off the radar a little bit and actually have to play that shot. So that was the coolest part, but it's not like something that was kind of, you know, staring out at you from the start.
Yeah. I'm not a huge volume guy when I watch golf in general. Mm. I tend to have it pretty low because I'm usually on my computer doing other things while I'm doing it. It's not like I, you know, have it all cranked up because I just don't think the crowd, unless it's a major, really adds that much. I agree. I thought I hardly noticed, you know, it was after a couple minutes, just like you said, Alex, it was just like a normal tournament. And, you know, I think there was some worry that it wasn't going to feel, the atmosphere wasn't going to be as big, you know, it wasn't going to feel tense, but I don't think that was the case. I mean, I was texting my friends as I do in real time when these things happen, like Morikawa's taking too long over this putt. He's taking too, like there was tension in the air and you felt that when he was lining up that 3-footer for par in the second hole. So definitely, it was definitely still nervous.
And I, you know, I like the confession cam or whatever they called it inside the ropes. The guys stopping in for a brief message. That was pretty cool. The mic'd up players kind of fizzled out, obviously, because Ricky Fowler ended up being the only one who did it. He did it for one day, and Ricky Fowler is, let's be honest, not the best for the mic'd up player. But hopefully we'll see more of that going forward. Sorry if you hear banging. It's people working on my roof. It's all happening now here. Anyway, I wanted to get into our chat with John Wood, veteran PGA Tour caddy, has been working on Matt Kuchar's bag for 5 years now. We talked last week to PGA Tour Chief of Operations, Tyler Dennis, about what was going to happen this week, the logistics and everything else. But now we brought in John as someone on the ground to actually take us through the week. What's different? What's the same? What's it going to look like going forward? And we talked about a lot of other things as well. Obviously, he's got some great stories. He's been out there for on the tour for over two decades. So please listen to our chat with PGA Tour caddy John Wood. All right, I'm excited to welcome to the Golf Digest podcast for the first time, veteran PGA Tour caddy and recording artist, John Wood. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This is great. Pleasure to be on.
So we'll get to your music a little later, but obviously we got to start with the Charles Schwab Challenge, the PGA Tour's return after 13 weeks. I guess, what was it like getting back out there?
It was great. I didn't know how much I missed it until I got back out there. I was kind of enjoying my time at home, but you know, just seeing the guys and chatting and seeing what you've been up to and giving the rib again to some guys and just being out there and feeling the competition again, it felt great. It felt great to be back out there.
Yeah, I think we should probably mention John is caddy for Matt Kuchar. I don't know if we actually mentioned that in the intro. So we were talking about this off camera. You said it was a rather tough missed cut for you guys this week. Tell our listeners what happened, people who might not have caught what happened with Kuch.
Yeah, it wasn't the best missed cut. He made a nice rally. He kind of just tread water the first day, and then the second day started playing really well on the back nine. Had it 4 under on the day, and we're going to make the cut, you know, by two, I think. And then hit it in the bunker off 9, which was our last hole, and unfortunately hit that one in the water and made double on our last hole to miss the cut by one. So not the prettiest way to come back, but it was nice to be out there competing again anyways.
But you've been around so long, that's nothing for you, right? You've seen everything in this game.
Kuch doesn't miss a lot of cuts, so it was a surprise. I've been very lucky. I've worked for a lot of guys who haven't missed a lot of cuts, so weekends off aren't necessarily what you're looking for out here.
Right. So, you know, let's get into some of the details. What about your job was maybe different this week than previously, obviously?
You know, once we got inside the ropes, not much. Other than, you know, coming off the greens, they gave us just wipes. We could wipe the flag stick down. Same thing with the rakes. If we were in a bunker, we had to rake a bunker. We wiped that down. The difference was kind of getting there, doing the test at home to make sure you could travel. And then when we got here, the first thing they had to do before we were even allowed on property was go and get a swab test. So got that. It couldn't have gone smoother. They had it set up so well. It was quick. We got our results within probably 90 minutes or so. So by the time I registered or got the swab test, went and checked into my place and got out to the course, I was ready to go. And that couldn't have gone smoother. The other things were just kind of, you know, socially distancing as much as possible out there. Knowing that no players and no caddies tested positive, you felt pretty comfortable once you were on the premises.
Right.
So they did a great job with that. And they really had so many redundancies in place for things that could have gone wrong. My hat's off to the tour. They did an amazing job in terms of getting things ready. They couldn't have done a better job.
Yeah, were you, I don't know if nervous is the right word. Did you have any sort of personal concern about, I don't know, you know, personally your health or just the logistics of how this is going to go down? Were you a bit apprehensive coming into the week?
For myself, personally, no. I was concerned for the tour and for the event, for sure. You know, if something had gone wrong or a bunch of guys tested positive, then obviously you're wondering if you're rushing back too quickly. So personally, I had no concerns for myself. But my concern was for the tour and for the event, that it didn't get some sort of a black eye. But I think that it came off with flying colors. You know, other than not having fans out there, you wouldn't know that anything was different.
So you're inside the ropes, your interaction with Matt were pretty similar. I mean, in terms of, you know, they talk about the guidelines with touching the clubs and this or that. I mean, you guys feel safe because you know, you're right. Okay.
I didn't see anybody changing their routine once we got inside. Knowing that, you know, Matt tested negative, I tested negative. There wasn't any sort of concern. And to try and figure out a new system, like, okay, you take the club out and then you clean it, put it back. I won't touch it and I'll clean this. And, you know, it's more trouble than it's worth, I think. We were careful. We weren't stupid about things, but we certainly didn't change our routine on the course.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of blowback. I think Brooks Koepka said in his pregame presser that him and Ricky weren't really going to change it up. And there was a little bit of like a reaction, but I mean, it makes sense really, right? Like everyone during all this has had people inside their bubble, right? Whether it's your roommates or, you know, your wife or your girlfriend, whatever it is. And like, you're touching those people. So it's kind of the same thing. And Matt's in your bubble and you guys, you know, you trust each other.
I honestly couldn't think of a way to change it up once you got out there. He's not going to, you know, you can't have the players pulling clubs and then cleaning them and then putting them back. I mean, we're touching them anyways because we're carrying the darn bag. So, you know, unless you got us pull carts and had us stand far away and, you know, that interaction between a player and caddy, a lot of times has to be pretty close. We're saying things back and forth we may not want other people to hear, whether it's players or caddies. So that interaction between us, I don't think anybody changed their routine. I didn't see it out there. And if it did, it was pretty well hidden. So.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that people maybe don't realize about caddying is how much of a rhythm there is to it. And, you know, obviously we caddied in the same group earlier this year.
Dan thinks he's a pro caddy now.
We're best friends. Well, I actually was going to say something that underlines my amateurism. I just felt like, especially for the first couple of days, like I felt rushed. Like it's, you know, there's so much made about pace of play. There's so much made about pace of play on the PGA Tour. So, you know, the last thing you want to do is be the guy who's holding everybody up. And these things, like these calculations, they happen quick. And to add a whole nother layer of like, I'm not touching this, you're doing that. Right. It just would have made, you know, it made it so slow.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I was the exact same way when I started my first few events. You know, I played high school golf, college golf. I thought I knew what golf at a high level was, when this is a totally new level. And the level of calculations you need to do and the rapidity with which you need to do them with, it's a totally different level. So it took me a while to get adjusted to it.
What about, you know, just the day-to-day logistics, you know, the caddy or player dining, that kind of stuff? Was everything set up differently this week?
It was. Everything was kind of – they didn't have usually the tournaments that do a great job these days of having prepared food for us, you know, different choices and hot foods and stuff. That changed this week. Everything was kind of pre-made salads, pre-made sandwiches and wraps, and everybody understood. It wasn't any sort of a big deal, and I think it was the same for the players. Just for a safety concern, you know, you can't have these open containers of food out there all day long and you never know what's going to happen. So that was a little bit different, but it certainly didn't lessen the event or make their job any worse. They did a great job.
And the no fans, was that just weird? Was it to make your job easier? I mean, a small part of your job is telling people to be quiet or telling them to get out of the way or, you know, stop heckling your guy. Like, was that kind of nice to not have that on your plate?
We were out with two of my best pairing on tour, Webb Simpson and Tony Finau, and I told Webb and his caddy Paul, I said, hey, if I just tell you guys to shut up a few times during the day, it's just my routine, okay? Don't take it personally, and you're fine. But I didn't think there would be that big of a difference until today, you know, when you got in contention and there wasn't that, you know, boisterous crowd and screams and groans, you know, knowing what's going on. And the first couple of days, you know, I think everybody out here, except for Tiger, has had those early morning Thursday tee times when there's nobody out there watching. So it was kind of felt like that. And it wasn't like the grounds were deserted. I mean, players and caddies were everywhere. There were officials, there were volunteers, certainly not the normal number, but it wasn't deserted. I had this picture in my head, like we were going to be the only people out there. And it wasn't that at all. So it didn't feel too strange. And I'm sure it felt strange for the guys today in contention. But right. Other than that, I didn't notice much of a difference.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Xander Schauffele made a comment about after he missed his putt, he was like, his little 2 or 3 footer that lipped out. He's like, you know, I didn't think about it, but maybe there would have been some pretty annoying groans. Maybe it was better for me that there were no fans there this
week. So true. So true. Right.
Did Matt or any of the guys in your group just instinctively, you know, wave to the crowd or acknowledge the crowd who that wasn't there?
I didn't notice anybody in our group do it, but I did notice a lot of guys doing it. You know, when I was watching the telecast, you know, it's just so routine just to go to your hat or kind of give it one of those when you do something good, just, you know, almost like muscle memory, you know? So I thought Ricky's was the funniest because Ricky kind of played it up and handed it up to the crowd. That was pretty good, I thought.
Yeah.
We missed the cut, which you never want to do, but I was toying with the idea of actually going out there today, being on the grounds and being a spectator and just messing with the guys, you know, if they would see me out there cheering for them and yelling and stuff, but I figured I'd better not get involved.
I got to ask, so Kuchar is probably the smiliest guy on tour. Was he as smiley this week with no fans, or is he smiling at the fans?
He's always smiling. He's a happy guy. Fans or no fans, he's always got the smile going.
Now, in terms of, you know, the PGA Tour has been talking about keeping this bubble with the players and caddies. So what was your lodging like, and what's your travel schedule like? I assume you're playing, obviously, this next week at Heritage, of course. Yep. Matt's had a great record there. What's the travel like from Colonial to there, and what's your plans going forward?
Right. I've stayed at Airbnb. I'm staying at Airbnbs these 2 weeks. I'm not a big hotel guy. I love having like little apartments or little condos, kind of having, you know, different rooms to stay in during the week. Right. So both weeks I'm staying in an Airbnb. Travel, they have a charter going on Monday. So I'm leaving tomorrow morning. And, you know, normally if we miss a cut, I would have gotten out of here right away. I would, you know, gone home maybe for the weekend, although going to the West Coast and the East Coast probably wouldn't have been done. But I may have gone and done something else. But being that, you know, they're kind of hoping that we stay on the charters and stay in that little bubble, I kind of decided just to stay here in Fort Worth and take the charter tomorrow.
Sure. Gotcha. So let's get sort of into John Wood, the man. Let's zoom out from Charles Schwab. You've been at this for a while. I think, you know, before Matt Kuchar, it was Hunter Mahan for, I think it was 9 years, you said?
9 years with Hunter, yeah.
And then before that was Kevin Sutherland for?
Calcavecchia, right before Hunter. Calc had a kind of a rotation for a while, and I was in that rotation where he kind of pick up guys in off weeks, and then I worked full-time for him for about a year and a half, and then Kevin Sutherland before that.
When did you decide that you wanted to, I mean, a lot of these guys, it kind of happens by accident. How did you become a PGA Tour caddy? Did you always want to do it?
Totally fell into it. It wasn't a plan at all. I was in Sacramento managing a bookstore of all things. And Kevin Sutherland from Sacramento, who I know really well, know his teacher very well. It was his second year on tour. And he had, you know, gone through a few different caddies in his first year and really wasn't happy or comfortable with any of them. And he and I were out just hitting balls one day, and he asked me if I'd be interested in coming out and caddying. And gosh, I never even thought about it. Never even thought about it until he brought it up. And then I gave it some thought. And Kevin was incredible. You know, I said, Kevin, you know, I'm giving up a job here. You know, I've got health care. I've got, you know, a good paycheck and a steady job. Can you guarantee me one full year? You know, because it could have been 2 weeks out there. He could have said, he's terrible, I got to get rid of him, and then I'm really in bad luck. But Kevin was great. He was patient with me. He said he gave me a full year no matter what. Super patient with me, learning on the job. Because like I said, I thought I knew golf, but at that level, it's a completely different animal. So he was – I couldn't ask for a greater guy to start with because he was so patient. And taught me some things about caddying that I hadn't thought of before. So it was – that's kind of, I just fell into it. And I think these days it's a little different. You know, you kind of play college golf with a buddy and he brings you out, or is your brother. Back then it was just kind of, it was something you fell into, not something you planned at all.
Now you were on the bag for him for a pretty amazing win at the 2002 match play.
He was
the number 62 seed. And that was when the old days of the bracket, just the bracket.
Right.
And I think you knocked off, David Duval in the first round, and you made a pretty magical run.
I think he beat five. He played six matches. He beat five current Ryder Cuppers that week.
Wow.
In match play, which is pretty incredible. It was such a fun week. It was funny. We were two down to Duval in the very first round with two to play. And I'm thinking, well, Duval's number two in the world. That's fine. You know, I hate losing, but I'll be snowboarding tomorrow and I have 4 days off. So no big deal. Sure. And Kevin birdied 17 and 18. And I think the second playoff hole, and you know, I don't think we didn't trail from that point on until McCarron came back and beat him.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you and Kevin were friends, you know, before. I'm wondering what that dynamic is like, you know, when a friend is your boss. Have you, in the guys that you've been with since then, have not been personal friends, unless I'm mistaken. How is the dynamic different with someone who it's a, you know, a professional relationship versus a guy where it's just, you know, your friend who decided to bring you out on tour?
Right. I honestly think it's easier to bring somebody you're familiar with and teach them how to caddy rather than find somebody that knows how to caddy and try and become familiar with them. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
it's a lot easier for me to learn somebody's game than it is to learn their personality, knowing when to, you know, pump them up, when to maybe give them a kick in the butt, when they want to talk, when they don't want to talk. So being that Kevin and I knew each other really well, that part of it was easy. And the mechanics of caddying was all I had to worry about. The parts about knowing Kevin became easy. And all the guys I've worked for since then were guys that I've kind of gotten to know before I started working for them. Calc is still a great friend to this day, and Hunter is still a friend. So I think it's two ways you can do it. Like I said, come out, get a tour caddy who knows the courses but doesn't know you at all, or come out somebody who knows you and let them learn on the job with you.
And yeah, it's interesting. What percentage of your job would you say is X's and O's, you know, strategizing, I like this line off the tee, I like this club, versus what you said earlier about pumping your guy up and really being kind of like a, you know, I don't want to say a therapist, but a sounding board out there?
No, your mind's constantly in two camps, two or three camps, obviously. You want to do your basic job, first of all, yardages and advice, of course. That's always going to be your number one job. You got that stuff right. You got to be on the ball. You got to be prepared for anything he wants to ask you. But another part of your brain is always working on, okay, is he in a good place? Is he in a bad place? If he is in a bad place, what do I need to say to get him out of it? Do I need to talk about something other than golf? I need to remind him of something his teacher told him, or remind him how good he is. I think when you get in contention, I think a lot of that comes into play more. Because you're right there. You need everything, you know, going the right way. You know, like I said, your mind is multitasking out there all the time. It's rarely, there's a few players that want just X's and O's. There's no question. But I think the bulk of them, you need to read them and get to know them well and figure out when those times are to talk about, to go off topic, talk about a movie, talk about sports. Or like I said, talk about something their teacher's working on with them. So your mind's always in different camps.
Obviously your profession, there's so much turnover, a lot of switching. You've had plenty of bosses, but it sounds like you're still good friends with all your ex bosses. I wonder.
Yeah. No bad breakups.
That's great. I wonder, like, is that a rarity that you have such a good experience with that? Because obviously, you know, caddies who change bosses are still going to see those players out there on tour.
Yeah. A lot of times there's kind of an awkward period when it happens either way, caddy quits or a player fires them. There's an awkward period, but usually they get over that. You know, you see them a couple of times or you get paired with them once, you know, and pass. And the bottom line is it's business. That's what everybody knows. And that's the bottom line, not to take it personally. It's business. And if you might be the best, greatest caddy in the world, but you click with somebody, and if he fires you, you just got to say, you know what, that's business. I'll move on and find somebody else. And players the same way. They, you know, if a caddy is not enjoying the job or feeling like, you know, I want to work for somebody else, then it's the same kind of thing. It's the bottom line. We're both businessmen. We're trying to do a good job out here.
Does that really happen? Do caddies really quit? I mean, because you hear about it and you think, you know.
Oh, sure.
He doesn't seem to have the leverage in this situation, but I guess it does happen. Guys say, you know, I'm not taking this anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys quit all the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you've got a good reputation out here and you quit the right way, you don't, you know, make it antagonistic and badmouth your old boss, you know, you're getting another job fairly quickly.
Yeah, I just got an idea in my head for like a social network for caddies and players. I think it's actually a pretty good idea because I'm thinking, how do you know when a guy gets fired? How do you know who's available? There could be an app for that.
You'd be shocked at the word of mouth out here. I mean, if a butterfly flaps his wings and a caddy gets fired in Japan, seems like we know about it 30 seconds later.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. I think, you know, a lot of people are just interested with, you know, those relationships and how you can switch around like that. But obviously it sounds like you're doing it the right way to keep moving on. You know, you mentioned Hunter Mann, obviously tremendous player for a good long period. One of those guys though, who's kind of, you know, fallen off the radar. I mean, what from your perspective, what do you think has happened? Is it just concentrating on his family life or what?
Yeah, it's interesting to say that. I think that's mostly it. He's an unbelievable dad. I've seen him with his kids, and that's his number one priority by far. And when that started to maybe take a little time away from his preparation or his golf began to suffer, and he started to lose a little confidence. And this game is all about confidence. And it's hard to get it back. So I think it's mostly his priorities in his life has changed. I think he loves being a dad. He loves being with his kids and his wife and home. And I think he's perfectly happy doing that. I think he's had his, he might, you know, I think he'll still play here and there, but I think he loves doing what he's doing now, and he's perfectly happy.
Yeah. And I think you were on the bag, correct me if I'm wrong, when he left as the 36 hole leader at the Canadian Open because his wife went into labor with the first kid. What was that like?
There's footage of us warming up on Saturday. I think we had like a 3-shot lead. Yeah. I mean, he hadn't missed a shot, and it was like, I was honestly thinking, how many are we going to win by? I just didn't see him losing it as good as he was playing. And then Saturday we're warming up, and I see his agent walk out onto the range, and an agent had never come onto the range before a turnaround. And as soon as he came on the range, I just, oh no. I mean, yes, that's great. I love that they were having their little girl, but the circumstances were, it was, I'm glad he went. He had to go.
Right.
And he made the right decision. How many times do you get to see a firstborn born? Right. So I was ecstatic for him and for Candy. And the funny thing was, Candy had gone to her doctor the night before, and he said, you're fine. You'll be right on time 2 weeks from now. Nothing looks out of the ordinary here. And so she called and told Hunter that, and, oh, great. And then that next morning, ready to go.
And Brant Snedeker ends up being the beneficiary.
I know. I still say, tell his caddy, Scotty Vail, he owes me a nice steak dinner over that one. But I haven't been paid off for it yet.
John, what was the first year that you caddied for Kevin Sutherland?
97.
Okay, so that's right when Tiger started.
I always mess with Tiger, and I tell him, you know, it could be – no one really knows for sure what spurred the tour. I came on at the exact same time you did, so – you know, it could be either one of us. right when Tiger was, you know, becoming Tiger.
Yeah. What was the, there's no really good way of asking this question from not saying just like, how amazed was everybody? But, you know, what was it like back then when you had this young guy come in? You know, what was Kevin's reaction? What were the other caddies' reaction when you had this guy who, you know, looked so different and hit it so much further than everybody else? What was that like right when that first emerged on tour?
It was awesome. It was something to see because you hadn't seen something, an athlete like that before, who could do so many things. There was still kind of a wait and see period because there is with anybody. There could be hype and you know, it can go away. But you know, that first, 10, 12 years was, it just kept going like this, better and better and better and more intimidating. And it was incredible to watch. The first couple of years, I'd say, was kind of, it was just fun, kind of seeing what he was going to do, what's going to happen. And then when he started to become that, you know, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002 Tiger, everybody was just in awe. I mean, everybody knew if he was decent, you couldn't beat him. He was going to win the tournament. But it was fun to watch. I don't know about you guys, but I'm not a Patriots fan, but I love watching excellence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not a Yankees fan, but I love watching when great teams are great teams and dynasty. Right. And it was fun to be even in that era and watch it and being able to tell, you know, your grandkids one day, did you know Tiger? Did you see him play? I said, every day. Yeah. And get to tell some stories and to get to know him over the years. It's been one of the best parts of this career.
Yeah. You said the intimidation thing, you know, you always see these stats about guys scoring average playing with Tiger, especially right. back then versus their normal scoring average. Yeah. So I'm wondering from experience, when a guy got paired with Tiger, were they just like, oh no.
I think the whole field was like that. I'll tell you a story. The Open Championship at Poy Lake, his first major after his father passed away. He was leading going into Saturday, and all week long, he had hit balls on the very, very, very far left of the range, right next to the trailers, hitting back into this wind. And it was kind of his spot. And on Saturday, Hunter had played a pretty good round and actually practicing after our round before Tiger because, you know, those tee times are 3:30 in the afternoon for the leaders. So we were hitting balls after the round, and Tiger came on the range And I'm not kidding you. There's 2,000 people in the stands, and there's 50 guys hitting balls. You didn't hear a word. You didn't hear a shot hit for the entire, 40 yards. He walked down to his spot. Everybody just stopped and just kind of went. And I looked at Hunter and I go, he just won the tournament. You realize that? He goes, yeah, I do. And it was just a moment you'll never forget, because, usually when a big player comes on the range, the crowd goes crazy, and he came on and everybody just went, it was like a library. I've just never experienced anything like that. It was really cool.
You mentioned the Open, and I got to bring up 2017, because obviously I think that was your closest and Matt's closest to winning a major. And what a crazy thing that happened, obviously, on that 13th hole. You have the huge delay. You're sitting there with Matt. Obviously, whatever you said to him, you did a good job, because he played under par the rest of the way. But then Jordan just went off. I mean, what?
Yeah.
Have you done anything?
Freak situation, everything about it was a freak situation. And Jordan and Michael handled it great. Obviously, they're trying to do it as fast as they can and figure out what they're doing once they found out that it wasn't out of bounds and they could play it from there. And, Cooch went ahead and hit a great shot up there. And then we just kind of waited it out. And, we were sitting there in the fairway talking to an official and hanging out. And kind of we could see it on the video screen, what was going on over there, and trying to figure it out. But Jordan, to his full credit, he came over the hill and came up. And we were on the green. His ball was still 20 or 30 yards short. And he came right up to Matt on the green before he even looked at his ball and said, I apologize. I'm so sorry about that. There's nothing I can do. And Matt was easy with it. So, Jordan handled it great. And the funny thing was, we went up there. He birdied the next tie. Then he made eagle on the next hole. And we're on that next tee, and he kind of leans over into my ear, because we're good friends, and I'm good friends with Michael. And he says, hey, Woody, I'm really sorry about that. And I said, Jordan, you do not need to apologize about that. You need to apologize about making that 50-footer for eagle on that last. And he says, that's just what I do. I can't apologize for that. If there's one person that, you had to lose to in that situation, those are two of my best friends out there. Gosh, we were so close, and it still stings to this day, probably always will. But, we got a one-up lead with five to play, and we played two under for the next four, and we were down three. So what are you going to do? We got beat. I don't think we lost it. We got beat.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you know Jordan and, basically all the American players from your time caddying in the – how many Ryder Cups and President's Cups have you caddied in?
Seven and seven.
Wow. The players always talk about how much more fun that is that week in the team atmosphere and the fans. Yeah. Is that the best week as a caddy as well?
By far. For me, nothing beats a Ryder Cup. Nothing. I grew up playing team sports. I was a baseball player. And you don't get that atmosphere ever out here. If you play 30 weeks and you play one Ryder Cup, 29 weeks of the year, I'm rooting for Matt. Matt's rooting for Matt, and his wife's rooting for Matt. And there's fans. And there's this, and there's that, and you've got your friends, but for the most part, you're a single person out there. In those Ryder Cups, when you get to be in the rooms with those guys and talk strategy and hear how they approach certain things, and during the matches when you're walking in between a hole and you're playing, and Phil Mickelson's sitting out the match, and Phil comes up and gets right in your face and says, let's go, come on, you guys got this. You don't get that, and I get goosebumps just thinking about it. And for me, the Ryder Cup is it. It's my favorite event by far. I just live for it.
Well, and you had an interesting experience at the last one, right? Because Matt was an assistant captain, right. But you were still there kind of helping the team, scouting, doing different things. I mean, talk to us about that. That's pretty cool. You still were involved.
Yeah,
not
totally.
Not caddying, but you had to.
Right. No, it was a whole new perspective on things, because when you're caddying, you're around everybody, but your sole focus really is Matt. And if he's got a partner, then his partner as well, kind of figuring out strategies and stuff like that. But to be able to see the thing as a whole and help out wherever he could, kind of looking at every situation and trying to be ahead of the game and help, the caddies, players, assistants as much as you can, even with ideas on pairings or, hey, so-and-so looks like this and I think he would do this. It was fantastic. I had a great time. But I'm not going to lie, come Friday morning, I was ready to, run over somebody's ankle so I could take the bag and sub in.
Right, right, right. Well, having gone through this week at Colonial, you know, a lot of people are questioning whether there should be a Ryder Cup without fans. I mean, obviously a tournament is one thing, but you're talking about the special atmosphere and everything. What would you think about that if they went ahead with the Ryder Cup?
There won't be a Ryder Cup without fans.
Okay.
I don't see how you can have a Ryder Cup without fans. Right. It's just not a Ryder Cup. It's
right.
I think they're going to figure out, I don't know what they're going to do. They're going to figure out a way, either less fans or, you know, divide the fans up into different areas, or I just don't see him having a Ryder Cup with no fans, and I don't think anybody wants that. You know, right. I don't think anybody wants that. Even if, let's say, we were going to Europe this year in this situation, right. I wouldn't want. You know, that is a tough. That's part of the Ryder Cup, going on right. the road and playing in front of a tough crowd.
Right.
And even if we were going over there last year, next year, this year, I wouldn't want it. You know, you want to be able to overcome something big, and that, you know, the fans are huge. They're a bigger part of the Ryder Cup than they are any other tournament. So, you know, I don't think we'll have one without fans. Hopefully they can figure out some sort of a solution to it to have it.
One Ryder Cup question that is not the happiest memory, I'm sure. You were on the bag for Hunter in 2010. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was that when he he's the chip against, I think he was against Graham McDowell. Is that right?
Graham McDowell, yep.
And he flubs the chip. It wasn't like they were, you know, he was already, his back was against the wall. I think they were dormy, so it wasn't like he was going to,
right,
wasn't in control of the match and choked away. Was that one of the hardest moments you've had as a caddy?
It was one of the hardest ones, sure. I felt so bad for Hunter because he had played really good golf that week. You know, and we were out last, and it's funny being out last, and I've been out last in two President's Cups now and two Ryder Cups, I think, and it's funny, that feeling is most of the day you're kind of by yourself. Mm. The fans are up front watching mm-hmm. the first matches, and Tiger and Phil. And and as the matches keep going on and matches end, you start getting more fans and more players and more caddies. And by the time we got to about 15, every single person on the property was on our hole. I've never felt more pressure. I'm sure Hunter never felt more pressure. And we were two down. He birdied 15 to get to one. And then it looks like, all right, game on. And then I made a great birdie on 16 to go back to dormy, like you said. Obviously I would change the outcome if I could. I wouldn't give up the experience for anything. Mm. I mean, for anything. It was one of the most thrilling, most pressure packed, fun, situations I've ever been in, you know, and, you know, the funny thing was, I think 2010 and then 2013 President's Cup in Korea or 15, maybe it was 15. I was.
I think 13 was at was in San Francisco, right?
Yeah. So 15 was Korea, yeah. And Bill Haas was in between caddies, and he asked me if I could caddy for him, and I absolutely said yes. And you know, we were out last, and his dad was the caddy.
Came through. He was the big. He was the hero.
Came through big, and I really felt like you know, Bill hit the shots, but I really felt like having been in that situation before helped me a lot as a caddy. I didn't feel overwhelmed by the situation at all, and I think was able to calm Bill down in a couple situations where it was so tense.
Yeah.
So like I said, I would change the outcome of that 2010 match, but certainly not the experience.
And then Cooch clinched it this year, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. And the funny thing was, I had no idea. If you watched him, you watch him make that putt.
Right.
And I didn't realize that everybody was watching, and I'm all from the other side of the green, just holding the pin. He knocks it in. I'm just casually strolling across and putting the pin in, looking like it's a Tuesday practice round. And only when I see Cooch skipping over with all the teammates, I realize, oh, we won. Cool. I didn't even know.
Bill is actually a classmate of mine at Wake Forest. And so I was one of the few Americans probably up at 3 in the morning or whatever it was watching that. That was intense. That really
was. I was so proud of him. He was so clutch. I was, you know, they were doing the pairings the night before. And I thought, you know, Bill's a great player.
Right.
He'll find it again, without a doubt. He's struggling right now, but he will find it again. But, you know, being a captain's pick, being your captain's the dad.
Yeah.
I kind of thought, well, they'll not hide him, but we'll go in that 3-4-5 area where it's not super pressure packed. And, you know, and they keep doing these drawings and there's no Bill Haas, no Bill Haas. Cooch and Bill were the only ones left.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, they'll put Cooch last. That's great. He's solid and calm as can be. And then they say Cooch is 11. And I'm like, oh my goodness. Here we go.
I didn't realize he was the coach's son. That's a real bold move.
Yeah, we got three up in our match early, and I thought hopefully you know it stays like this. But you know, Bay came back and tied the match at one point. And I remember making the turn, and I was debating whether to say something to Bill or not. But I decided to say it just so he wasn't overcome with emotion when it came down to us. And I just said around 10, I said, "Hey, Bill, look at me right now. It's going to be us. Just be ready for it. Be prepared. I don't want you to be surprised at the end, but looking at the board right now, it's going to be us. So just keep doing what you're doing and be ready for the situation." And and he played, he didn't miss a shot coming in. It was some incredible golf he played. And he was nervous. I was nervous. You're supposed to be. And he just came through big, and you couldn't write a storybook ending better than that. I mean, winning the President's Cup for his dad and his dad's only captaincy. He just did. There was a lot of tears that night in the team room with him and his mom and his dad.
I'm sure. You know, I know I've read you talk about this. You've hardly ever missed a tournament in your life. And you miss the one in Mexico with Kuchar. You know where I'm going here.
I'm going to plead the fifth.
Oh, can you believe all that happened from the one time basically that you miss an event?
You know, Amanda Baliones from CBS texted me about a week after it happens. She said, "You take 1 week off and you break the tour. You know, don't take another week off." It was really an unfortunate thing for Matt to win a tournament and have all that happen. And you know, he felt horrible about it. And I think he came back and fixed the situation. And he fixed the situation by paying El Toucan. But then I thought the really classic thing was, not even anybody knows this, he brought El Toucan out to the Mexico City event that year, just privately, and they just sat down with them and said, "Hey, I'm sorry how this whole thing went down. I didn't want this to go down like this. I'm glad we figured it out. I just want you to come as a, you know, just to watch golf for the week and apologize to his face." And not many people know that, but I thought that was a great touch for him to do that.
That's great. Yeah. Wow. Very good. We mentioned your music at the beginning of the thing. I've been listening on SoundCloud all day. I mean, it's great stuff. I love
it. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Birds. James is a beautiful song. I know it's about a friend of yours. Where did the music bug come about for you?
You know, I've always been a huge music fan since I was a kid. I mean, little kid. And music's always been that place for me in my life where I could go, whether things were great or sad or whatever. And it was always something that comforted me and made me feel like other people feel like I do. And it's okay. And I've just always had a huge passion for music. And I've always had friends in bands who played music. You know, I never really thought I could do it. I had a guitar for a long time, and then probably, 10 years ago, I really started playing and you know, just learning other people's songs and stuff like that. And I had a great time. And I thought, I wonder if I could write a song. And I just tried to do it one day, and it wasn't as magical as I thought. You know, I could do it. And I've had a blast with that. It's been great for my mind to get something creative outside of golf to kind of focus on. So it's just not something I ever thought I'd be capable of doing, but I certainly enjoy it these days.
Yeah.
Do you and Matt ever jam out? Are you and any other players or caddies on tour?
Mark Chaney, a good friend of mine who works for Fred Couples, unfortunately on the Champions Tour now. He's a great bass player, so we would have been playing a lot together, I'm sure, at this point. But no, a few other guys travel with guitars, but it's kind of a solo thing. And I'm sure I will get together with somebody at some point out here, but it's kind of a nice rounds over, come back, relax, and you know, just kind of get your mind on something else for a while.
Very cool.
Don, before we let you go, I have to ask you one question. It's a very hard question. In your 23 years on tour, who is the best 1 week guest fill-in caddy that you've ever seen?
I'll tell you, Joey D.
Oh, come on.
And I would say you, without a doubt. I mean, you did things that other people can't do, but people only dream of doing. Right. But Joey D, who was VJ's trainer, okay, he was a trainer. He wasn't a caddy. he caddied for VJ 4 times 1 year and won all 4 events.
No way.
Oh my goodness.
It was in VJ's 9-win season. So, you know, VJ probably could have strapped the clubs on a poodle and won all the events anyways. Right. But Joey D, in terms of a fill-in, is legendary.
That's a great answer.
In terms of 1 week only is done.
Well, yeah, one week, Dan, you get the nod. There you go.
My fault.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. Obviously, we're glad to see Matt and you and everybody else out there. And seriously, everybody listening, check out his SoundCloud page. He's got some great tunes. Keep it up. Awesome. Good stuff. Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks again to John Wood for joining us. Guys, let's talk. There's a couple more big storylines this week. Bryson DeChambeau, speaking of big, that's who we need to talk about, because obviously he didn't get the job done at the very end, but I think this was kind of the latest proof that his experiment, if you want to call it that, is paying dividends. Right, Dan?
Yeah, it's hard to argue with results. I think he has 4 top 5s in a row now. And it's funny because Colonial is not a course where historically length has paid off. It's been, right, of course, as you look at the list of past champions, you know, it's like Steve Stricker, Kevin Na, guys who don't hit it super far because it's angly and there are dog legs. Well, dog legs are a lot less intimidating if you just go straight line over the corner. He had something like, I think his average yardage into greens this week was 100, into par fours was 116 yards. Hmm. So, I mean, he's hitting sandwich into 450-yard holes. It's going to be interesting to see. You know, it's not like this is the consensus best way to go forward, because we saw Gary Woodland, you know, he decided he wanted to lose 25 pounds. So it's not like people are saying, oh, Bryson's doing it, so I've got to do it. But you do wonder if guys are going to start. There's been this stigma around chasing clubhead speed because, you know, they're cautionary tales like Luke Donald, you know, someone who was not a power player and chased miles per hour and really fell off. But you wonder if that's going to start to happen again, because Bryson, the difference is he's not hitting it crooked. That's what it is.
Right.
I would say, you know, and there was some comments by Colin Montgomery that, you know, this is sort of a sign that something needs to be done, that this guy sort of overpowered this golf course. For some reason, the fact that he is so much physically bigger now plays into this narrative that some of the artistry is lost out of the game. You know, like we've had guys who are super long, but they still kind of look like golfers. When you have a guy who, you know, Koepka kind of has that mold as well, but when DeChambeau puts on, you know, X number of pounds and looks completely different, it sort of plays into this idea that, you know, the game that we knew, the game that, you know, was taught to all these guys is now suddenly, you know, receding. And that, you know, this is the key. It's just bulking up and getting huge. You know, if he starts winning tournaments en masse because of that, you know, let's talk then. But, you know, I'm not yet convinced that it's like the difference maker for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say that it would work for everyone, but certainly it would work for him, because, you know, you think when you bulk up, it might hurt some other aspect of your game. But obviously, if you're finishing one off the lead, I think he has 2 tournaments in a row where he's lost by a shot, or at least the Mexico tournament and now, I don't know if they're back-to-back, where he had the lead with a couple holes to go and he made a late bogey. Obviously, the other aspects of his game are working well. I mean, look, off the tee, his last 2 events, he has been about a stroke, 1.8 strokes gained off the tee. And to put that in comparison, he's about over a half shot better than anybody else per round. So that's 2 events in a row where he's gained over 2 shots on the next best person in the field over 4 days.
Yeah, I saw a stat. Like his lead over Schauffele, I think it was, who was second, was as drastic as Schauffele's lead over the 25th guy.
Exactly.
So he's a bit of an outlier. You know, we'll see if what kind of courses it translates to, because people do say this stuff about Colonial, but, you know, there is, you can't hit it over the trees. Harbortown is not really like that. So it'll be interesting to see how he fares this week. But, you know, my whole thing with Bryson, I think people are starting to come around on him a little bit, is like the guy just really cares and he's really trying to find anything he can to give himself a professional advantage. And I think we probably can all learn from that a little bit. You know, he's on a true earnest quest to get better, and he doesn't seem to really care if he, you know, pisses people off or if he's the butt of some jokes because he's on this pursuit of excellence. And I think there are a lot worse things in golf and in sports than caring a lot. And that he clearly cares.
Yeah. One other thing I'll say about Bryson, which I think, you know, is worth noting, it's not like he was this sort of middling player who put on all this mass and suddenly became, you know, really good. I mean, he was on this trajectory anyway. He's a, you know, a top 10, top 5
level player. Yeah,
of course. So, you know, an excellent elite talent who now took this step. Now, if you had, you know, player number 60 in the world or something like that, added 30 pounds and suddenly was, you know, on top 5 of every leaderboard, that would be a different story.
Right, but it's even scarier that it was already a great player making this drastic transformation. And I mean, it's possible that he could be the best player in the game very shortly. I mean, if this keeps up, if he's going to have that edge every week, and again, the rest of his game is somewhat decent. I mean, man, he's starting with a head start.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I think Dan's point is,
Sorry, it's amazing. You go.
Dan, go. You speak.
Okay, I'm speaking. It's amazing to me how hard he swings. You know, it's one thing to hit it far, but it's another thing to swing completely out of your shoes,
which
is what he's doing. I mean, he looks like a long drive guy out there. It's not like, you know, easy power. Or even Koepka, you know, when he's swinging hard, he still holds the finish, sticks the finish.
Right.
This guy is swinging out of his shoes as hard as he can, and it's going straight, which is a testament to athletic ability and practice, and he's dialed it in. You know, if, like you said, it's all about whether he can keep hitting it straight. He's going to keep hitting it far, but when you hit it that far and when your ball speed is 192, 1 degree off, you know, is magnified. So he's going to have some weeks where he's spraying it, and he's probably going to miss some cuts, but he's also going to win a lot. So it is a fascinating case study, and I think we're just at the beginning of it.
You know, I was going back through how he compared to other guys. The only other guy in the last 2 years who even comes close and actually has topped him a couple times, both in terms of strokes gained off the team and in terms of distancing from the rest of the field, is Cameron Champ.
Mm-hmm.
And he's another guy who we had, when he came along, Sean Foley said, this is like Usain Bolt versus everyone else. I mean, he's by far the fastest. He's got this edge. Now there's Bryson. Who knows, though? Maybe we do start to see other people start to pursue this and not let these guys get ahead. And same thing with Champ. Like you said, Dan, he has a lot of bad weeks, but the weeks that he's on, he's won a couple times already. So, you know, it shows you how important, obviously, driving is. Obviously, Bryson has figured that out. That's why he's put the emphasis on this. But, yeah, it's just the beginning. But I thought for a while Bryson might struggle. The fact that he's already posting these high finishes has to be really encouraging for him. Another guy, big storyline throughout the week, was Harold Varner. You know, obviously a disappointing finish on Sunday, but, you know, with everything that was going on, it was pretty remarkable that he was in the lead and holding strong. And, you know, we talked about how maybe on Sunday afternoon with the no fans, maybe that would help a guy get over the top. So I thought it was setting up for him on Sunday, but instead he unfortunately has a track record of maybe finishing poorly on Friday on the final round. It happened again, but how about his week?
No, that's what I was alluding to when I was saying that, you know, it had the makings of a really special week on a lot of levels. I mean, how cool would it have been, given everything that's going on in this country, for Harold Varner, who not only, you know, is black, but also has made some really profound, compelling comments about race in America, for him to win the first, you know, real professional sport back, you know, that's what I mean by
to get his first win.
It would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, just to have him front and center for as long as he was and play well. I mean, I'm sure, you know, again, talk about guys whose personalities that we enjoy and, you know, can kind of sustain a level of interest. He's the type of guy that would do that. So, I would have loved to have had a better finish, but I'm happy that he actually had a strong week overall.
Yeah, if we're being honest, I mean, the Daniel Berger victory was probably near the last thing we wanted in terms of intrigue. So
you kind of look like Daniel Berger. You guys kind of have similar, you know, kind of reddish curly hair.
Both have the same name, and we're both Jewish, so there's a lot of similarities.
<Yeah, same. laughs>
One other guy, I know we got to wrap up, but the Jordan Spieth. I mean, this guy on Sunday, it's a wild ride. Well, any day, really, it's a wild ride, Dan. I mean, what is going on right now? He straightened out his driver the first few days, but then, you know, he makes these birdie runs. He three putts from 3 feet. Yeah. He hits it out of bounds. It's all happening with this guy.
Watching him is just stressful and tiring. And also, right. You know, they say Ricky Fowler was the only one who was mic'd up. I feel like I heard every single word Jordan said
that's the true. Whole week.
I don't know if he's just talking loud and the mic is right there, but yeah. I don't know. He made 7 putts outside 20 feet this week. Like, what?
Crazy.
Yeah. Well, there was a, I forget what day it was. I think it was Saturday where he was sitting over a putt. It was like a 15 footer and he missed the putt. It was a sizable putt. And the broadcast was like, you know, we're now getting into that mode where we're expecting to make all those. Like, that's, you know, his one advantage. Like, now you're starting to create this expectation. Not only, you know, he's having that expectation, but like watching at home, you just start expecting to make all these bombs. And when he starts putting like that, you know, he's you know, obviously very dangerous.
Yeah, I think he's close. I actually do. And I know that's like, golf attitudes, but you know, he had a couple victory. I mean, he had a 2-shot lead at one point, you know, and he just hasn't been able to put 4 rounds together, but we see that his best is still, you know, it's still one of the best in the world. So it's just about putting 4 rounds together, but I'm ready for him back. I'm ready for him to be back in the mix. It was great seeing him up there.
Oh yeah. Very exciting to watch, but yes, it was great seeing anyone out there. It was fantastic to have the tour back. Kudos to the tour for pulling it off. We haven't heard of any positive COVID tests either or anything like that. So fingers crossed we go on to the next Harbortown next week and we keep it going. Guys, it was a lot of fun. It was great talking to John Wood. Thanks again to him for joining us. Thanks as always to our producer, Greg Gottfried. And thank you for listening. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done so already and check back next week to see who our guest is.